prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply, it's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
No, it's not freezing in the studio. I'm wearing this hoodie because I made the bad judgment call of wearing a yellow T-shirt today. And as you can see, it looks like it turns to chrome thanks to the green screen technology. I forgot that green is a component of yellow. I think I learned that in second grade. Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We have two new studies we're going to talk about today. The first is going to be about HRT. The second is going to be about blood pressure. And hopefully people will take some good information away from this. Of course, you can always help communities out by sharing the show right now, regardless of what platform you're on. There's usually a share button. You can click it now as the show begins. Of course, we have to thank our title sponsor, and that is Legendary Foods, makers of the Tasty Pastry, which started out as an alternative to the Pop-Tart and has become so much more. When you eat them, you really think you're eating pastry. The texture, the mouthfeel, the chew, the flavor. You'll eat them because they're delicious, but there's good news. Less than 1 gram of sugar and 20 grams of high-quality protein. Flavors are outstanding. Go to shrnetwork.biz/legendary. Use the code SHR10 to save 10% off. And, of course, listen during the commercial break. There will be a secret word hidden between commercials. And when you hear it, just write it into an email. Send that email to onair@superhumanradio.net, and you will be sent a care package from the folks at Legendary Foods. And I'm talking about not just tasty pastries, but their seasoned almonds, their delicious nut butters. The list goes on and on. We have so many people who have received these packages and are astonished by the generosity of Ron Penna and the folks over at Legendary Foods. So keep your ears open. Listen for that secret word. Now, without further delay, a returning guest, and that is Dr. Stephanie Fabian. How are you, Dr. Fabian?
I'm well. Thanks so much for having me again.
Yeah, you're great. And you talk about, we try to do shows that focus on hormone replacement therapy, especially for women. And it's because to this day, I'm always astonished how many women don't know about hormone replacement therapy. And what they do know quite often is misconstrued because of the early studies in the Women's Initiative health program. There was lots of information that scared women away from HRT. And there were lots of devils in the detail that, that are just coming out now. So let's talk about your latest research. You looked at heart disease and type 2 diabetes, right?
Yeah, this wasn't actually our research. I think you're quoting a Korean national health study, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, the results of that large population study did not show any protective effect, but it didn't show any harm related to hormone therapy use with regard to diabetes or heart disease risk, which is reassuring. I think back, you refer to the Women's Health Initiative study, and, you know, that showed us that time since menopause is important and age is also important. So, you know, most of the women we're giving hormone therapy to are newly menopausal. So these are women in their 50s, which is a very different thing than giving hormone therapy to a woman in her 70s.
Yes.
When she might have already developed some heart disease. And so what we found with the Women's Health Initiative after time and analyzing it in the people that tend to use it, which is younger women, that it really doesn't increase the risk of heart disease. And in fact, it may actually be even protective for those women in their 50s. But also, we found that there was a significantly reduced risk of diabetes in those women. So while this new study didn't show that exactly, it didn't show harm, which is quite reassuring.
So let's talk about a couple things. Whenever we talk about, first of all, women's hormone replacement therapy tends to be more complex than men. Because women's bodies are much more complex than men, because women can actually manufacture a human being. With that being said, is there any way to tease out, when we look at this type of research, the women that were on equine estrogens and progesterones and or methylated drugs, because we know that methylation changes the landscape of the liver, increases thrombotic index all by itself without it being attached to a hormone per se. Do we ever know really if it's the preparation that's causing the unwanted effects versus the hormone?
You know, that's a really great question, and one that we haven't fully fleshed out yet. And the reasons for that are that the Women's Health Initiative study was done using drugs that are different, frankly, than what we use now. It used conjugated equine estrogens and medroxyprogesterone acetate. So medroxyprogesterone acetate is a very different animal than micronized progesterone, which is essentially progesterone, which is what the body makes. There have never been head-to-head trials comparing the two of those. So that is really, really difficult to sort out what the differences would be between medroxyprogesterone acetate and progesterone. So don't have that answer. Not sure that we ever will, because to be honest with you, that's a multi-million dollar trial that you're talking about, and I'm not sure it will ever be done.
Yeah, because then no one profits from it. You know,
Right. Exactly.
The pharmaceutical companies pay for those studies, and they're not going to pay for a study that shows that their product is less effective than...
Especially when it's a generic,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
No one's ever going to pay for a study using a generic drug.
See, and this is where I feel like the NIH falls short. You know, are they interested in the truth, or are they only interested in what someone is willing to fund? The government has the ability to divert funds and to find out if there is any difference. Obviously, they will be biting the hand that feeds them, because the pharmaceutical industry doesn't want to know that for whatever reason. But the people need to know that. It's important for health.
I agree. It's an important issue that we need to be able to study. So we have observational data, so we can look and just see when women take a particular drug. Does there appear to be a different outcome? But that's not the same rigor as having a randomized controlled clinical trial.
So this most recent paper that we're here talking about today basically says, look, it may not be protective. It may not help, but clearly it doesn't hurt. And that kind of takes the brakes off, as we call the green light, gives a green light to women who are looking at HRT as a modality to treat their menopause.
Yes, and I think, you know, this study just confirms what we knew already. So I don't think it really changes a whole lot out there. But I think you made a good point earlier that there's still a lot of fear and concern about hormones that we need to try to clear up. So while this shows pretty much the same thing that we've known already, I think the bigger conversation comes around how do we educate women, how do we educate providers who are taking care of women about hormone therapy, because it's just it's a battle. As you know, talking with providers who were educated back in the time where they thought hormone therapy was frankly evil, and trying to undo misperceptions that are out there, because at the end of the day, hormone therapy is still the most effective treatment for menopause-related symptoms, and the benefits outweigh the risks for the majority of women who are under the age of 60 and within 10 years of their last period.
You know, I'm a huge fan of critical thinking, and doctors are some of the most well-educated individuals on the planet. They're given access to information, but they stop short. Not all of them. There are bumper crops of physicians today that are really doing real medicine. Not like, here's your prescription, go on your way. They're really thinking about things. But if I was a physician, the question that would be in my mind that I'd be pondering all the time is, women have these hormones from the time puberty forward, in outrageously high levels, and then they go through menopause. What makes these hormones bad actors all of a sudden if it's not the preparations? And let's ignore the preparations. Let's look at bioidentical, as you point out. If they're not these methylated and equine, why all of a sudden something that women had ragingly high levels that did not promote breast cancer and uterine cancer, because we don't have that in 20 and 30 year olds to the degree we have in older women, and most of those have gone through menopause. You know, why don't doctors ask that question? What made estrogen so bad all of a sudden, and when it was fine when they were young? Or is that oversimplified question?
It's a bit oversimplified. But I get your point. So it's not that we had outrageously high levels at around menopause, because the hormone levels, frankly, start to fall before menopause happens. And then the other factor that you didn't factor in there was age. So as you correctly mentioned, you know, breast cancer incidence increases with age, as do most cancers. Most Yes. cancers are more common as we get older. So I think you have the factor of age and what aging does to the body. And we start to develop heart disease. And at some point, you know, the balance of hormones on top of heart disease isn't favorable. And there is that tipping point, and who knows where that is for any one individual woman, where then the risks become greater than the benefits. But for, as we stated, you know, for most younger women who are in their 50s, and I love calling 50 year old women young.
I know.
the benefits are going to outweigh the risks of hormone therapy. But I think the other factor is age, and the whole risk benefit balance changes as you get older.
So not all women, and this is true of all medicine, not all people respond the same to different therapies, and not all women respond, let's say, favorably to hormone replacement therapy. Do you think that that's because we have this cyclical nature of hormones? And doctors just go, well, we're going to give you 2 milligrams of Biest, and we're going to give you, you know, 50 milligrams of progesterone you take at bedtime, without taking into consideration these hormones line up in a woman, you know, luteal phase, the follicular phase. Do doctors pick a phase and say, we're going to bring hormones into the range of that phase? Or do they just arbitrarily say, you know, this is what everybody else prescribes here, I'm going to prescribe this for you?
Okay, you bring up a couple of really important points that we need to talk about. So one is bioidentical versus compounded bioidentical. And when you're talking about bias, that's compounded bioidentical, which we don't promote. And there are a number of reasons for that. So the compounded varieties, typically, they aren't FDA approved or regulated. So often what's on the label is not exactly what's in the bottle. And then there's some concerns about safety along with efficacy. So none of the major medical organizations get behind compounded bioidentical hormone therapy. Having said that, there are plenty of FDA-approved bioidentical formulations of hormones. And what do I mean by that? I mean estrogen that is chemically, structurally the same as what the body used to make, and that's estradiol. And for progesterone, it's progesterone. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about bioidentical. But there's a difference between FDA-approved bioidentical and compounded bioidentical hormones, with FDA-approved being preferable.
But FDA approval meaning only estradiol is approved. Is that what you're saying?
And progesterone.
Right.
Right.
But is there no value? I know estrone is considered not the good form, and it does convert into estrone in the liver. But is estriol a dangerous form of estrogen?
We don't know if it's dangerous per se, but there's no evidence that it's any more beneficial than estradiol. And it's, in fact, very weak compared to estradiol. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. even when you're taking the two hormones together, the bulk of what most women are getting if estradiol. They take the combination is actually estradiol.
Okay.
So back to that other point about is there benefit to cyclicity,
yeah.
You know, meaning that our hormones are at different levels during different phases when you're talking about a premenopausal woman. So when you're talking about a postmenopausal woman, it's important to understand that we are not trying to replace what the ovary used to make before. We are not trying to mimic physiology from before. What we are trying to do is manage menopausal symptoms. And so what we try to do in clinical practice is not achieve a particular blood level. We try to use a dose that manages the woman's symptoms. So we are tailoring it for each woman, but we're basing it based off her response in terms of symptoms, not trying to get to a particular blood level.
That's interesting. So you're really just looking for the lowest effective dose to get these symptoms to go
away.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Do you think women can stay on HRT indefinitely, or do you think that they must stop at some point?
I don't think it's as black and white as that. So here's the question. We know that starting women early appears to be better than starting women when they're older, right, in terms of risks. We have never had a clinical trial that has told us where in there does it suddenly become dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have no randomized clinical controlled trial data to say at what point is it not okay anymore. So this is all going off expert opinion. But what I do, I can tell you what I do in my personal practice is, you know, I think for most women who are under 60, the benefits outweigh the risks and we're managing symptoms. And I think it's fine to do that. After the age of 60, it becomes a conversation. And it's a conversation that involves what are that individual woman's particular risks for, say, breast cancer, for heart disease, et cetera. And what are her symptoms? And what are we trying to fix here? Is it hot flashes and night sweats? Is it protecting her bone density? Is it a quality of life issue, or is it just personal preference that she feels better on hormone therapy? So I have plenty of women on hormone therapy after the age of 60, and I don't have a black and white cutoff for when someone must come off. And I think we need to individualize how we practice medicine a little more than saying it's a black and white, you know, yeah. You can have it for 3 years or 5 years or age 60 or whatever the cutoff is. That doesn't make sense for individualizing medicine.
No, and I admire what you're saying, because a lot of physicians talk about individualized medicine, but when it comes down to practicing it, it's a different story entirely. Carmela Cierzo, who's watching the show from Canada, said that her endocrinologist has a woman in her 80s on HRT. When they would try to take her off, the symptoms came back, so she's still on. And that's what you're talking about with the individualized medicine.
I had an 80-year-old woman in my practice as well. And actually, she came to me because someone else had taken her off hormone therapy 6 months earlier. And the poor woman had not slept for a single day since then.
Poor thing, yeah.
And so I put her back on it. And I said, you know, at this point, she's already proven that the benefits are outweighing the risks for her. And we're making her miserable, just trying to make ourselves more comfortable, right? So I think you have to individualize it based on the woman. And for a poor 80-year-old who hasn't slept a day in 6 months because you took her off hormone therapy, at what point does do no harm come into effect?
Right. One other thing I want to bring up, and actually – this is something that I've learned when I was using performance-enhancing drugs in weightlifting, that drugs, these drugs, these hormones don't mask or prevent the damage from bad lifestyle. And I know that there's a lot of women out there. I have a cousin who blamed HRT for her cancer, but she was easily 70 pounds overweight, drank a lot of wine all the time, ate a lot of highly inflammatory pasta and, you know, I'm Italian, carbohydrates all the time. And then when she got breast cancer, she says, oh, it's the HRT. When women choose to get on HRT, I almost feel like they must first make a decision to clean up their lifestyle too, because the fuel you're giving the car will do more harm if it hits a wall. You know, it's great on the highway, but if you go into a wall, you're just going to hit the wall harder. Speak to the fact that there's a responsibility when you're going on HRT, please.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. And you know, I don't think it's just with HRT. It's all of us. We go into our physicians and we ask for a pill to fix things when it's really a lifestyle issue, right? So, and you could say the same thing about hypertension and hyperlipidemia. And while, yes, not all hypertensive women are overweight, I think there's a lot we could do in terms of our lifestyle. So when you look at breast cancer risk, weight has a huge impact on the risk for breast cancer. And really, it probably is more of a factor than hormone therapy. when it comes to wine intake, the risk of breast cancer associated with hormone therapy is somewhere between the same as 1 and 2 glasses of wine per night. So I think women need to understand that their lifestyle factors are not inconsequential. They have a lot to do with their future risks. And it's not just breast cancer. It's all kinds of cancer that are increased with obesity. So thank you for that. I think anytime we start women on hormone therapy, they need to be, told about the risks and benefits of hormone therapy. So are there potential risks? Absolutely there are. And you need to understand what they are. But often they're in line with other lifestyle factors. And in fact, we could really go a long way to reduce our risk if we really paid attention to lifestyle. And here's the thing. It's hard. It's hard work mm-hmm. to keep your weight where it should be. It's hard work to exercise every day. It's easier to take a pill, right? But that's not going to fix a whole lot of things.
That's right. So, first of all, real quick, if there are any women listening to the show and they would like to connect with you, maybe to seek you out as their physician, how would they do that?
So I'm at Mayo Clinic, and mayoclinic.org is a good way to find me. Also a good reference is menopause.org. That's the North American Menopause Society, and there's a lot of good resources on there for women and for medical providers. But we really try to stay cutting edge and evidence-based, and there's also a locate a provider tab on menopause.org where people can actually find a certified menopause practitioner who's gone through some education and testing to show that they have knowledge about menopause.
Do you think male doctors can treat women for menopause as effectively as female doctors? I don't, and I'll tell you why, but what do you think?
Absolutely they can. Absolutely they can if they've been educated, and we actually try to promote having male doctors educated about menopause, because you know what? That's important. And even in our clinic, when we train male residents and have male residents go through our menopause clinic, women love talking to them, and they love talking to the women, because if somebody's knowledgeable about these things, that's really what women are looking for, is somebody who knows what they're talking about, who understands what's the symptoms that they're having, not that they had to have them personally, but that they know the treatment options. So I think it's really knowledge over having a common experience necessarily.
When I was deep into performance-enhancing drugs, I was using some very powerful aromatase inhibitors, and I crushed my estrogen levels, and I became I developed insomnia, subjective tremor, anxiety. I couldn't sleep. It was just bizarre. So at night I would search for my symptoms, and I'd always end up at a menopause website. Yeah, Power Surge. I don't know if you remember. Power Surge was an old website where women went to talk about their symptoms and commiserate and get relief. And I was like the only guy on there, and I'm like, oh my God, like I literally put myself into menopause. And I have a profound sensitivity for women when they go through menopause, because I thought I was dying. I mean, I'm not kidding. I drove myself to the emergency room 4 or 5 different nights because I was like, something's wrong with me. Something's got to be wrong with me. They're like, no, you're okay.
You know, and this is so unfortunate, because I've had patients come to the Mayo Clinic for an evaluation thinking that they were dying because they had so many symptoms that are alarming. And you can understand if someone's having heart palpitations and anxiety and they're gaining weight and their hair's falling out.
They can't sleep. I used to roam the house at night. My whole family would be sleeping. I felt like a ghost. I would look into the kids' bedroom.
And they're irritable. And, you know, the whole thing is just extremely uncomfortable. And when women aren't prepared for some of these symptoms, and don't get me wrong, not every woman has all these symptoms. You know, some women literally go through menopause, stop their periods, and have nothing. And in fact, when I was writing our menopause book for Mayo Clinic, my mother asked me, why are you writing a menopause book? And I said, well, Mom, I've never really asked you about your experience before. What was it like? And she said, well, I may have had a hot flash once at a cocktail party when I had a glass of wine. And I thought, wow, okay. Well, that is not the experience that most of my patients have had. So many women are just confused because there's not a lot of education around menopause. And I think we need to do a much better job of educating providers about menopause, but also women about what happens during this time, because it can be confusing, scary, terrifying, actually, and women don't know where to go for help.
I don't know if I, and this is the last question. I don't know if I've ever asked you this before, but did you find any correlation between adipose tissue and the ease of going through menopause? Do leaner women tend to have worse symptoms? Do heavier women, only because of the aromatization of androgens into estrogens? Anything there?
Okay, so this is a really complex issue, and I'll tell you why. So heavier women sweat more, right? So they can sweat more. They do have more estrogen on board. So they have shown that some women who lose weight, it can help a little bit, but in general, weight loss can help. Weight loss is not going to help a skinny person, but right. Weight loss from a heavier person might help a little bit. But here's the caveat, though. So I've had heavier women on hormone therapy who lost weight and started having more symptoms because they lost estrogen because they lost fat. So they needed to go up on their estrogen dose when they lost weight. So weight and menopause are complicated.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Dr. Fabian, thank you so much for coming on. Hope we see you again. You always bring great information for the audience. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. And we're going to take one quick commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to stay with this topic of sexes. And we're going to talk about blood pressure and the relationship of blood pressure and the differences between men and women. Stay tuned. You are watching and listening to Superhuman Radio. We'll be right back. Every day, there's a new wellness trend. Eat that. Do this. Avoid those. How do you know where to start or who to trust? Inside Tracker helps you cut through the noise by analyzing your blood, your DNA, your lifestyle, and your fitness tracker to provide you with a science-backed, trackable action plan on how to live, age, and perform better. Personalized one-size-fits-one recommendations to help you optimize you. For a limited time, Inside Tracker is offering Superhuman Radio listeners 25% off the entire store. Go to shrnetwork.biz/InsideTracker, InsideTracker, to save 25% off. Change begins on the inside. Remember those rectangular toaster pastries you used to love when you were a kid? Well, Legendary Foods has just made them better. The new cake-style tasty pastry is like nothing you've ever had before. With 20 grams of high-quality protein and less than 1 gram of sugar, you'll feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to shrnetwork.biz/legendary and use the code SHR10 to save 10% off your purchase of tasty pastries. Now available in cookies and cream, red velvet cake, birthday cake, blueberry, strawberry, brown sugar cinnamon, and hot fudge sundae. Go to shrnetwork.biz/legendary and use code SHR10 today. Have you been struggling to achieve results in the gym? Trouble sleeping through the night? Overwhelmed with stress or anxiety? Look no further than Infiniwell supplements. They have designed products to address specific needs like muscle growth, hormone balance, sleep, and anxiety from the first use. Infiniwell helps you live well. Go to shrnetwork.biz/bewell, that's B-E-W-E-L-L, and use code SHR20 and start living well today.
New Mass Pro Synthogen X2 just upped its own legendary game. To distance itself even further from the rest of the pack, Synthogen X2 now has double the key active ingredients. If you've ever wondered what steroid-like recovery feels like, Synthogen X2 delivers. See why others compare it favorably to powerful bodybuilding drugs at Synthogen.com. Mass Pro Synthogen. When you train with it, you'll gain with it.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or ability to achieve your goals? BetterHelp can help. They will assess your needs and match you with a licensed therapist. This is not a self-help or crisis line. It's professional counseling done securely online. They have a broad range of experts and are available worldwide without having to wait in an uncomfortable waiting room. Get the help you need and start living a happier life today. Go to shrnetwork.biz/betterhelp. That's better, H-E-L-P. And receive 10% off your first month of counseling when you use the code SHR. Redcon One's new BAR bar is the ultimate soft-baked protein-packed snack bar powered by peanut butter. Perfect for while on the go to help curb hunger or sneaky sweet tooth cravings. With 20 grams of protein, use as a meal replacement bar or when you're in need of a high-protein snack. Eat a Redcon One bar as a midday snack or for fuel before an intense training session. Go to shrnetwork.biz/redcon1 and use the code SHR25 and save 25% off these delicious bars. $1,000 today.
You're listening to the Superhuman Channel. We're ripped and we're ready.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're joined by Dr. Mykola Mamenko. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mamenko.
Thank you. My pleasure. Can you hear me well?
Yeah, I hear you well and see you well. And I'm very excited about this interview. Blood pressure has been something that's fascinated me for a very long time. And we've talked about blood pressure on this show under various guises, if you will. And your group just published a study that looks at the gender differences between both managing blood pressure and treatments, correct?
Well, I would be accurate with the definitions. So we just got a grant project from NIH to study those differences.
Okay.
So we've got some pilot data, but it's a little bit premature to say that we have confirmed everything. We anticipate and we have strong preliminary support to say that there are differences, but this is under investigation.
Okay, so let's talk about how – so this sounds like a review or a meta-analysis. What would you call this? Is this a review of the existing data?
Well, no. This is a basic research. So it's been long tangentially known that females can be more responsive to aldosterone inhibitors such as spironolactone or eplerenone in terms that they can receive additional benefits as compared to men. And this can be in terms of the heart function or recovery from myocardial infarction. There is some tangential evidence also about hypertension. But so far, there is no conclusive evidence, and actually clinical studies call for more evidence, more mechanistic evidence that can be provided by research scientists like myself to establish what could be the mechanisms and where this benefits, where there's some mechanistic pathway that underlies those differences. So we study differences in animal models of hypertension to elucidate what could be the differences between males and females. I can elaborate further, or
I want you to elaborate further, but I have some questions. So obviously there are several mechanisms that can cause hypertension. Obviously the first one is vasoconstrictive effects, peripheral blood vessels, as we see in angiotensin converting enzyme being higher in the presence of high insulin. But then there's also renal issues that can potentiate high blood pressure. So do you start by teasing those out first?
That's exactly the point. We speak about hypertension as about disorder or disease, but in my leisure time, I prefer to think of it, and in my own thoughts, I prefer to think of hypertension as a symptom. It's like fever. You can get fever because you got regular cold, flu, or COVID, or food poisoning.
Right.
And these all will result in fever, but the mechanism will be different and the treatment strategy will be different. It's absolutely the same with hypertension. So hypertension is a disorder or a symptom that is caused by a myriad of reasons that can involve cardiovascular system, heart, or the kidney. I would think from my standpoint as a renal researcher that kidney is the central thing, because if we imagine our body or cardiovascular system, try to model it in terms of engineering. So we have a piping, which is vasculature, extensive piping system that leads to the organs, and we have a heart that is a pump. Unfortunately, this system wouldn't be fully reflective of our body because our cardiovascular system is not completely closed. We eat, we drink, so the volume always changes. Mm-hmm. So what we need to maintain a constant pressure and flow in that system, we need some check valve, which is the kidney.
Right.
So kidney not only removes the waste product, but it also serves as a check valve. And unfortunately, when we get not super healthy and when our blood pressure increases, all organs can auto-regulate the blood supply to them by constricting the blood vessels, by shutting down those valves a little bit. But kidney cannot, because it's the pressure regulator valve. So it can auto-regulate to a certain extent, but at some point it has to stay open, first of all, to be able to remove the waste byproducts, and secondly, to regulate that blood pressure. So we are ending up with a vicious cycle here, whereby high blood pressure damages the kidney, and as your valve, the kidney is damaged, it induces higher blood pressure. So in my view, kidney plays a very important central role, and our research is centered actually on the differences in the kidney. We hypothesize, we anticipate that female kidney is much more responsible to aldosterone blockers when females are hypertensive than male kidney. You may ask, what is the reason for that? We know that females have higher expression of aldosterone receptors in the kidney. And when we think of importance of any sensory pathway, we have to think twofold. I think most of our listeners have some home pets, dogs or cats, and we pretty much well know that they have higher sensitivity in terms of smell. So if I put a piece of meat or a piece of sausage, the stimulus will be the same for me and my dog. But my dog, I bet, will be able to sniff that piece of meat from further away.
Right.
So what I'm trying to say is that in our body, when we think about signaling, it's both the drug or the hormone that is circulating, but also the receptor that senses that hormone. And what we are saying that females have higher levels of aldosterone receptors in their kidney. So they are more sensitive to aldosterone than males, at least in a hypertensive state. Again, the reason for that, because people also ask, and that's what our project also wants to investigate, is why. Physiologically, normally, there are high aldosterone states in females where they use that aldosterone to retain volume. For instance, during pregnancy, volume increases dramatically when the child is developing in the mother's body, because it has to account now for actually two circulatory systems, but blood pressure doesn't. So in pregnant females, it's regulated in a way that it's useful. But what we think that in hypertension, something goes off, and this system no longer works as it should.
Okay.
And this is why they're so more now, sensitive.
And these are questions that I have in my mind. Okay, so first of all, one of the most important things that the kidneys do is regulate electrolyte concentrations in the
right.
blood. And for years, we've had doctors tell patients, cut back on your sodium, cut back on your sodium. And they also will say, well, you know, don't take calcium supplements. Don't take magnesium supplements. And I happen to know for a fact, because I have a friend who is a renal specialist, that the kidneys must work harder to blockade and keep electrolytes in the bloodstream when there isn't adequate intake, which is exactly the opposite of what most people think. If you have high sodium in your food, and since you're talking about aldosterone here, because that's part of the aldosterone mechanism, right? Sodium,
yes.
Okay. If you have high sodium in your food, assuming that your kidneys are not broken already, it's a big one. If you have high sodium in your food, the kidneys don't have to work as hard. They can let everything go past. They don't have to filter as hard because they know that there's plenty of sodium in the bloodstream. They don't run the risk of running out of sodium, which is critical for electronic impulses like heartbeat and so on, and they work less. But we are being told by people that high sodium is dangerous. And in fact, Dr. James D. Nicolantonio wrote a fantastic book 5 years ago. He was on my show called The Salt Fix, where he showed that people who had high blood pressure, who were on sodium-restricted diets, their blood pressure improved without having to take more medication when they started putting sodium into their diet. So there's a lot of emerging and very interesting information as it comes to minerals and the kidneys. But the other thing that I wanted to mention was when women are pregnant, they can undergo a life-threatening event called preeclampsia, correct? Isn't this a high blood pressure? I mean, the fetus can die, the mother can die. Is that what preeclampsia is?
Yes, and one of the symptoms is high blood pressure.
Okay, so we're saying, well, women are different than men when it comes to this. What if it's just estrogen and progesterone?
I think part of it is exactly what you're pointing to, and my bet would be on progesterone, because high aldosterone states in females, like during pregnancy, they are paralleled or associated with high progesterone. And there was a study, I would say about 10 years ago, actually about familial preeclampsia. So normally progesterone is anti-aldosterone, but in this family, there was a mutation in aldosterone receptor that made progesterone stimulating aldosterone receptors. So these pregnant females were not only high on aldosterone, but they were obviously high on progesterone during their pregnancy. And that was like a double killer for them. So it's absolutely true that there can be an interaction between sex hormones and specifically between progesterone and aldosterone. So I couldn't be more in agreement with what you just said.
Okay, so let me bring one more thing into the discussion. Hyperinsulinemia leads to high levels of angiotensin-converting enzyme. We know that angiotensin-converting enzyme shuts down peripheral blood flow to bring blood into the core, because usually angiotensin-converting enzyme is required during fight or flight. Because if you have to run for your life, you don't have to worry about blood in your fingertips. You have to get everything in here so the heart can pump, the legs can move, and you can go. And we know that estrogen and progesterone play a profound role in blood sugar management for women, especially postmenopausal women, that in fact hot flashes and subjective tremor are the result of mismanaged blood sugar all over the hypoglycemia, hyperglycemia. So in women, could it be also that in older women versus younger women, it's a completely different mechanism, because as older women start to experience trouble managing blood sugar, angiotensin converting enzyme goes up and throws yet another problem into the mix?
Speculatively, I could say yes. There is no exact good evidence for that, but there's a high rationale to anticipate that that could be true, because obviously hormonal levels change. And that absolutely can be true. However, when we think about even hypertensive women, I would think that there could be different causes of hypertension. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't just nail it down to angiotensin-converting enzyme or even aldosterone for that matter. Mm-hmm. And I think what our study tries to pursue and persuade is that there are cohorts of people or cohorts of patients that will have specific factors contributing to that hypertension. And nowadays, when you're hypertensive, say like my mom, who came to the doctor, throughout her life, her pressure was just normal. She came with hypertension at the age of roughly 60. And the drug that she was prescribed was ARB, angiotensin receptor blocker.
Right.
The prescription was made largely as a guesswork. Oh, I don't know, maybe that family doctor just attended a seminar on ARBs. It's not a bad drug, but in 2 weeks, my mom was pretty satisfied with her blood pressure, which went down, but her heart rate was around 100. Mm-hmm. So what they do in terms of blood pressure, they just do the guesswork with you, trying to adjust your therapy to your blood pressure outcomes. Unfortunately, what that results is in poor compliance. Because if it doesn't work, people start to get aggravated. They say, oh, that's a bad doctor, or that's a bad drug, or I don't want to take it. Another problem is non-compliance, because mostly it's older people who come with hypertension. Right. So they can, if one drug is not effective and they prescribe two or three, that's a bunch of pills you need to take. So the problem becomes not to forget to take all those drugs. So it would be much better if we could run a panel of tests and tell, oh, you have high aldosterone levels, so you'll be good, well treated by eplerenone, or you have high angiotensin II levels, so probably ACE inhibitor will work for you, or maybe A or B, or maybe there's sense to give you both, or maybe calcium channel blockers.
Right.
They do this to a certain extent, but like I said, largely in clinic, it still remains a guesswork.
Yeah. The way they do it is they start you off with one pill. It doesn't work. Then they try the other one. It doesn't work. Then they try the other one. They go, oh, this works. But by then, you're almost a year into not – and plus – each of these therapies comes with its own ill feeling. You know what I mean? Oh, I don't feel good anymore. I've lost my libido. You know, people don't realize it, but beta blockers, which is a very popular blood pressure medicine as well.
This is what my mom ended up having.
They make people depressed over time. You know, beta adrenergic receptors are in every part of tissue, every part of the body, and the longer someone's on a beta blocker, they start to become lethargic and less interested in life. And all of a sudden, it's like, yeah, I my blood pressure is great, but I am not living anymore. So all of these drugs have their own unwanted effects, you know? And so it's really – I love what you're saying about coming up with a way to determine what works best for who. I want to take one commercial break. Stay with me because I want to talk about testosterone, because testosterone does something for men – that we don't want. And as we age, you have to be careful about this. Stay tuned. We're going to be right back with more Superhuman Radio, and we'll be addressing this on the other side. Stay tuned.
Being superhuman means being conscientious about the choices we make. White Oak Pastures is superhuman when it comes to raising livestock. They're committed to animal welfare, land regeneration, and rural revival. They responsibly manage the entire process from the pasture to your doorstep. High-quality, pasture-raised, great-tasting meat from a farm you can trust. Full nose-to-tail selections. They even have options for your pet. Go to shrnetwork.biz/whiteoak and use the code SUPERHUMAN to save 10% off your entire first order. If there is one mineral you should be worried about not getting enough of, it's magnesium. Magnesium is the body's master mineral, powering over 300 critical reactions, including detoxification, fat metabolism, energy, and even digestion is influenced by the presence of magnesium. That's why I'm so excited to tell you about a new magnesium product I've been taking now called Magnesium Breakthrough. It's the ultimate magnesium supplement, easily the best I've ever seen or experienced. With all seven forms of magnesium, I was able to arrange an amazing deal for my audience, and I guarantee it's the best deal available on this product. Seriously, with volume discounts combined with our custom 10% coupon code SHR10, you can save up to 40% off select packages of Magnesium Breakthrough. And I promise that this deal is only available on this specific website, magbreakthrough.com/SHR. You won't find that deal on Amazon or even on the company's own website. Go to magbreakthrough.com/SHR and use code SHR10 to save up to 40% off select packages of Magnesium Breakthrough. I would easily say that I am the hugest proponent you will ever meet to doing anything that will improve the quality of my sleep. And that's because sleep is linked to just about every metabolic disorder we see in our population today. One of the easiest things you can do to improve the quality of your sleep is to get a pillow that can be shaped into the exact form factor that allows you to get your best night's sleep. And that is my pillow. I've been sleeping with my pillow for a few years now, and I can tell you that when I have to travel and stay in hotels, I don't get a good night's sleep because I don't have my pillow with me. Right now, you can save up to 60% off of everything offered to improve the quality of your sleep at shrnetwork.biz/mypillow when you use the code SHR. Or you can call toll-free 800-889-4938. And remember to use code SHR to save up to 60% off of everything at their website.
Is there something interfering with your happiness or ability to achieve your goals? BetterHelp can help. They will assess your needs and match you with a licensed therapist. This is not a self-help or crisis line. It's professional professional counseling done securely online. They have a broad range of experts and are available worldwide without having to wait in an uncomfortable waiting room. Get the help you need and start living a happier life today. Go to shrnetwork.biz/betterhelp. That's better, H-E-L-P, and receive 10% off your first month of counseling when you use the code SHR.
I want to introduce you to TauPatch, a heavily researched patented wearable device that provides immediate and long-lasting health benefits. TauPatch's nanocrystals convert your body heat into light of specific therapeutic frequencies that optimize your central nervous system. The health benefits of TauPatch include relief from chronic pain, better sleep, increased focus, reduced stress, improved athletic performance, and more. Discover what it can do for you by visiting shrnetwork.biz/TauPatch. That's T-A-O-P-A-T-C-H. Use code SHR for your superhuman discount today.
Hey, this is Carl Lenore. Superhuman Radio is the longest-running health, fitness, and anti-aging podcast in the world, going into our 16th year of continuous production. If you have a product that you think would appeal to the superhuman nation, we can get you on the air quickly and inexpensively to help promote your brand. Join the ranks of some of the largest and most successful companies in the world who know how great it is to be affiliated with Superhuman Radio. Contact Dan Kopitzky today, that Dan.Kopitzke at superhumanradio.net to learn more.
Move over, superheroes. This is the Superhuman Channel.
A little later in the show, I got videos of Dan Kopitzky. He's pitching their championship game today in Arizona. This is not the first time he's done this. He's bringing his team a victory. I predict they will be the champions of this national competition. And I've got some videos of him. And always, so Natalie, who is our social media director, always puts war paint on his face and braids his hair, which I know isn't probably politically correct today. But Dan is a great pitcher. I'm going to show you some videos after this interview. So I want to talk about testosterone for a second. I am on testosterone therapy. I have been since 2007, but I understand the risk that occurs with testosterone therapy. If you have a cardiac ischemic event, it can actually damage the heart more because it increases the stroke. While testosterone has been shown to be protective for men, it increases the stroke of the heart. The heart keeps trying to beat while it's being starved for oxygen, and this can actually damage the heart to a greater degree. I have to believe that women have testosterone. Does that play a role in blood pressure at all, Dr. Mamenko?
Well, we must say that sex hormones like testosterone, progesterone, estrogen, and aldosterone, the receptors for them, they are sort of like cousins because the structure of the ligands is very similar. So not only that, but the receptors in between themselves, sex receptors like androgen or estrogen receptors, or progesterone receptors, they can interact with mineralocorticoid receptors. So there's definitely a role. And if we speak about male during the active life reproductory period, it's very well known that hypertension-wise, males will be more susceptible for hypertension. I would draw some attention to the fact that everybody says that females are protected during the reproductory age. But the fact is they are not protected so that they don't develop hypertension. Their hypertension rates are lower, but they're not zero. I would say that testosterone probably is the main player in males, while progesterone and estrogen is in females. So that would be my take on the hormone of sex hormone and hypertension levels.
So
because
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
So your research basically is opening up the door to say we need more research so that we can identify the specific pathway or mechanism for one person's hypertension versus another person's hypertension before we suggest a therapy. Is that correct?
That is an exactly correct assessment of what we want to do. We want to say that it is very likely, and we confirm this in two different animal models of hypertension, specifically not to be biased to say, well, it works in one model and maybe that's specific to just one single model. So we did it in angiotensin II dependent hypertension and we did it in salt sensitive hypertension, which is also a quite relevant trait of hypertension in the United States and all over the world. And we can see that these hypertensive females, they respond better to aldosterone antagonists, both in terms of their blood pressure and in terms of salt handling in the kidney. The aldosterone blockers allow them to dump that excessive salt with urine. Coming back to your point where you said that actually if kidneys excrete sodium, they work less. To a certain extent, that is true, but not completely, because evolutionary, when we developed as a species, our kidneys were designed to reuptake as much sodium as possible, because our normal diet, like try eating anything that wasn't cooked at the restaurant or at home, you will feel immediately it's not salty enough. So the kidney was evolutionarily designed to reuptake as much as possible. So the current, today's logic of what we eat, it completely upsets the logic of the kidney. Instead of retaining that sodium, it must redesign itself to dump sodium. In a way, I can agree with you that excreting is less work than retaining. But the fact is, imagine that you are trained to do something your whole life. So sometimes not doing it for you can be more work than doing what you were used to do throughout your whole life.
Well, what about? Do you think there's any difference between sodium that is part of the flesh of a tomato and sodium that we just sprinkle on food, that, you know, because we're learning a lot about the microbiome and the digestive system. We know that certain things are better absorbed down further in the small intestine or in the large intestine as opposed to the gut. Like, for instance, years ago, we did a show that showed why flour, acellular carbohydrates, feed bad bacteria in the gut, because those were designed to be broken down further down through fermentation. But once you turn it into a powder, the microbes up here, they can eat it, and then they produce toxins. So do you think there's something like there are people who looked at the paleo diet and said, back in the day, the Paleolithic humans, they hunted, gathered, and they ate all day long, and they got 10,000 milligrams of sodium in their diet, but it was bound to food. It was bound to something. You think there's something different about free-form sodium chloride than there isn't when it's in a food?
So there are two aspects to that. So first of all, I don't think that there's any difference between sodium in the tomato or sodium that we add with whatever food additives we can do today. And I would suggest that 10,000 milligrams of salt per day with paleo diet is a little bit of an estimate, to be polite. But the other thing about it is that sodium in the tomato or sodium in the paleo diet is not necessarily sodium chloride, because what we put when we put 50, salt 50. In our diet is sodium chloride. Sodium can come in many different other flavors, like sodium carbonate, for instance. And there are actually studies showing that it really matters what that sodium actually comes with. If it comes in the form of carbonate, it can be even protective, because carbonate makes our blood more basic, and this reduces inflammation, and this can be beneficial. So it really matters what flavor of sodium, what do we take? Is it sodium chloride, sodium carbonate? What type of salt we are putting in it?
And let's not forget, hunter-gatherers sweat all day long because they moved all day long. They didn't eat it and then sit at their desk all day long. So that has something to do with it.
That is also true.
And I actually take sodium bicarbonate every day for my kidneys to keep them healthy. I learned on a show probably a decade ago that when people have chronic kidney disease, they give them sodium bicarbonate tablets, 600 milligrams each. They take them two or three times a day, and it keeps the disease from progressing. So I actually added sodium chloride, sodium bicarbonate to my diet. I use Arm & Hammer. I take 1/8 of a teaspoon and I throw it in water. I drink it down once a day just to be, you know, protective. So what do you hope people take away from your research?
So I hope that people will understand that hypertension is not one positive disease, that hypertension is more of a disorder or a symptom that is brought by multiple other problems in our body. And they have to be, at this point, patient and careful and work with their family physicians to identify what their problem is and to select a proper drug. They should be working on this diligently, because otherwise they end up with uncontrolled hypertension, which becomes a silent killer for them, because it continues to damage their organs. It continues to bring havoc in the body. It continues to move on with cardiovascular disease. So it's really important for people to understand that sometimes, especially with genetic forms of hypertension, doctors have a very good understanding of what the reason is, and they can treat it very well. Sometimes you have to just simply brace yourself and go through that adaptation period, which is what I was, for instance, repeating to my mom. You cannot abandon. You have to try this. You have to try that. It's not a bad doctor. We have multiple options of treatment. You have to try. You have to be also, how to say, very organized, because when you try something, when the doctor prescribes you a drug, he hopes or she hopes that you're taking it, and you're taking it regularly. So if you're not, let them know that you're not, because you can be looking for that right drug like forever. So yes, my take-home message is that this is a serious thing, especially for the younger people who tend to dismiss it, because hypertension itself, it doesn't or it shouldn't, just by high blood pressure, does not give you any pain oftentimes or any bad feelings. So, but don't dismiss it, because the consequences are there. So don't dismiss it and be organized about treating it.
Very good. Very good message, Dr. Mamenko. Thank you so much for being on the show today. It's a very serious subject. And I'd love to talk to you about how blood pressure is tested, because I think that's a farce. Since the 1800s, I can put my arm straight out. I can rest it. I can put it down. I get three different readings.
Well, this is certainly a point to discuss. But I mean, we have what we have. I can speak of my personal experience. Most of the time, I arrive at the hospital, it's some sort of a regular checkup, and I'm late and I'm running. So most of the time, my blood pressure shows as high. Every time I remeasure it in calm conditions, it's just normal.
Yeah, I have white coat syndrome, I've been told. I can check my blood pressure at home. It's 137 over 67. If I go into the doctor's office, I feel the cuff blowing up. I get anxiety. My heart starts beating. Oh, my God, it's 200 over 100. We need to put you on blood pressure medicine. I say, no, I check it at home all the time. And now, luckily, I have a physician who understands this, but it's anxiety that I get.
Well, this is, again, that's what I mean for people, that it's not that they come to the doctor with hypertension and just delegate it, sort of like you bring a car to the dealer and give them the keys and tell them, repair it, I'll come back and take it back.
Right.
It's your responsibility as well. So if you come, even with the blood pressure, yes, you might have higher blood pressure in the office, or you might, the opposite, have the lower blood pressure in the office. Just take regular measurements at home. Sometimes it's not even the degree of hypertension per se. It might be that it doesn't dip at night.
Yes.
And that is important. So you just have to be organized and diligent about controlling and observing yourself. Your physician has, I don't know, hundreds of other patients, so they cannot afford taking deep look in all symptoms and problems. You have to help them. They are well educated and they can help you, but they need to know the information. And it's, I think, equally a responsibility of the patient and of the doctor to work on this and find the best way to treat it.
Thank you, Dr. Mamenko. Have a great weekend. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Have a good day.
Before we sign off, I am being told that it's getting very close. I just want to show you a couple videos. Let me just get rid of this line across the front of my face. So Dan Kapitsky's team is winning, and I can honestly say it's because he's an amazing pitcher. Dan is a true superhuman. That's a snapshot of him pitching today. And I think this is also, I don't know, you can't tell right there, but he has a, there you go. You can see the feathers. He has his war paint on that he always wears. Natalie puts it on him for the final game. And it looks like hopefully by now they've won and they are the champions again. So we're rooting for Dan Kapitsky. And he is a true superhuman. He's responsible for all the sales here at Superhuman Radio. But he maintains a gym where he teaches other people to play baseball. And he's out there doing it too, not just teaching people. All right, that's it for today. It's Friday. I hope everybody has a great weekend. We'll see everybody next week. And don't forget, share the show. You never know whose life you may save. Thanks a lot.